This week on Making Contact.
My check is going to come every month. It's not going to be based on how the stock market's doing. Then I can at least know that out of all the other things to worry about, that I don't have to worry about that.
Ever since Franklin Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act in 1935, the program has been debated by liberals and conservatives alike. On this edition, we'll explore the importance of the program to those often overlooked in the current debate over Social Security, like young people and the disabled. We'll also hear from author Thomas Frank on some of the larger historical and political issues involved. I'm Justin Beck, your host on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information.
Today, a hope of many years' standing is in large part fulfilled. The civilization of the past 100 years, with its startling industrial changes, has tended more and more to make life insecure. Young people have come to wonder what would be their lot when they came to old age. The man with a job has wondered how long the job would last. This Social Security measure gives at least some protection to 30 millions of our citizens who will reap direct benefits through...
Signing the Social Security Act of 1935 was one of Roosevelt's most memorable accomplishments as president. As the U.S. suffered through the Great Depression, Roosevelt envisioned a nation of social insurance that minimized personal financial catastrophes caused by free market capitalism.
We have tried to frame a law which will give some measure of protection to the average citizen and to his family against the loss of a job and against poverty-stricken old age. It seems to me that if the Senate and the House of Representatives in this long and arduous session had done nothing more than pass this security bill, Social Security Act, the session would be regarded as historic for all time.
Before Social Security, half of all elderly people in the U.S. lived in poverty. Today, that number has been reduced to 10%. Still a lot of people, but far fewer than before. The fight over Social Security has been going on as long as it's been around. For instance, in 1964, Barry Goldwater proposed that the program be made voluntary. 70 years after its inception, Social Security has come under new attacks by conservatives, who say it's facing an inevitable crisis. The fund's trustees warn the program will go bankrupt in the year 2041.
7 years from now, the baby boom generation will begin to claim Social Security benefits. Everyone in this chamber knows that Social Security is not prepared to fully fund their retirement.
As early as February of 2001, President Bush was promoting the idea of replacing the current system with what he calls personal savings accounts. This is the president addressing a joint session of Congress.
And we only have a couple of years to get prepared. Without reform, this country will one day awaken to a stark choice, either a drastic rise in payroll taxes or a radical cut in retirement benefits. There's a better way.
But supporters of Social Security say there's no crisis at all. They say the whole point of privatization is to funnel cash into Wall Street, in turn creating a bubble in the economy. Others, like author Thomas Frank, say it's part of a right-wing plan to roll back the New Deal. Frank is editor of the Baffler magazine and author of the recent book called What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. He's a vocal opponent of many of the right's initiatives, like Bush's Social Security plan.
We have to stop thinking of this as a kind of dry, you know, a matter of budgetary numbers and benefits cuts. And we have to start remembering the critical symbolic significance that this issue held for our ancestors. I mean, Social Security wasn't always this boring issue. If you go back to when it was started, this was the basic values issue. This is something that mobilized people in the streets. It was the crowning achievement of liberalism. And it writes into law the fundamental liberal precept that acting through government, acting together, we can tame the brutal forces of the free market. We can control our own destiny. We can raise people up out of poverty if we want. We can achieve what Roosevelt called freedom from want, right? That's basic. That is fundamental. That is what liberalism is about. And that's why it infuriates the Republicans so much and why it has infuriated them all the time since 1936. And why they campaigned against it then and lost so overwhelmingly. The first reason why the right desperately wants to kill it is because it is one of the most effective and most popular government programs of all time. And as such, it legitimizes and popularizes the idea of government intervention in the economy generally. If you kill it or just undermine it by making fun of it and talking about how it's going to go bankrupt or whatever, you have struck a heavy blow against liberalism. And they know this. And free market true believers back in the 1920s and now again today believe that Wall Street is the proper guardian of retirement savings and that everything else is arrogant overreaching. There's an interview with Grover Norquist. This guy is super smart, and he thinks very strategically. Unfortunately for their side, he opens his mouth a little too much. But there was an interview with him on TV, and basically, you know, he brushed aside the idea that Social Security is in crisis. And in fact, it is not in crisis, not even anywhere close to being in crisis. And he said, basically, we want this to happen so that people will no longer identify with government, but they'll identify with corporate America. They'll all hold stocks. They'll all identify with Wall Street. That's what it's about. They are talking about combat on a gigantic historical level. It's not about the numbers. It's not about the system going bankrupt. The thing about Social Security is that it is one of the largest streams of revenue going into the federal coffers. It's run a surplus for decades now. And what they do with that surplus is they lend it out to other branches of government, and it's spent on other federal projects. If you take that stream of revenue away and send it instead to Wall Street, you instantly have pulled the props out from under government generally. And lastly, when you do this, and this is the most critical thing, you give Wall Street enormous political power. Now, in official DC circles and in the media, you know, the so-called the liberal media, it is believed that Wall Street is politically neutral. It's just another institution out there. It has no political agenda, right? But I'm here to tell you that, in fact, it does. Wall Street loves things like downsizing and outsourcing and anything else that will hold the line against worker power and also anything else that will empower management and allow them to deliver shareholder value, like, say, polluting or, you know, beating up union organizers, anything like that. They love it. Now, you hand the fate of our senior citizens over to Wall Street, which is the idea here, you effectively make these attitudes, these political attitudes, into the de facto economic policy of this country. They used to talk about Social Security being the third rail of American politics, the idea being you touch it and you're dead, right? Don't ever criticize, don't ever attack Social Security. What the Republicans have in mind is handing that colossal power over to Wall Street. There's no senator or if they do this, there's no senator or congressman anywhere in the country that will do anything that might impede Wall Street's way, you know, their drive for profits. Because if they do so, look who they're hurting. It's the retirees. It's the senior citizens. It's the people that we love the most. What they want is touch Wall Street and you're dead. And that's what they're going to get. I've been, you know, fighting over this now for years. I first looked into the matter about 5 years ago and started writing about it for Harper's Magazine. And there is no crisis in Social Security. You know, the shortfalls that they're talking about are things that are either going to correct themselves or can be corrected with tiny, tiny modifications. But I was reading this interview in USA Today the other day with some senior citizens that live in, you know, down in Southern California. And they were all saying, all those guys in Washington have loused everything up again, and they've spent all the Social Security money, and they've ruined it. They're just, because the president told them that this had happened, they can't imagine that the president would lie about something so important. Okay? And the thing that's missing from our political debate, I mean, many things are missing from our political debate, but the sense of history, that this is not just, you know, some guys, you know, this is not just President Bush saying, wow, the previous administrations have ruined Social Security and it's my job to clean it up. No, you have to put this in the context of the last 70 years. This is a fight that goes back for decades, for hundreds of years, if you think about the broader reform movement that got Social Security in place in the first place. We have to remember who our ancestors were and how they beat the free market believers in the first place. And they didn't do it, you know, with this kind of complacency, this kind of, you know, reaching out to the middle and this sort of thing. That's not how they did it. They did it by criticizing. And that's what we have to embrace.
When I get older, losing my hair, will you still be around? Will you be invested in a private account? Have I got something to worry about? If I pay in, then will you pay out? I won't ask for more. Will you still be there? Will I get my share when I'm 64? I've asked my daughter if she really thinks I ought to move in.
She's got an extra room.
According to government figures, in 2005, Social Security will pay over $500 billion in benefits to nearly 48 million Americans. Roughly two-thirds of recipients are retired. Another 6 million or so are the often overlooked disabled population. Correspondent Leanne Caldwell visited with Vanessa Swindell, one such disabled beneficiary.
I've always been very driven to do well, to prove myself, to make an impact, to show that there's a reason why I'm here. And at work, I excelled. I did a good job at work. And that's where I got my self-worth, and that's where I felt comfortable and at home. And everything else, being so sick and always feeling like I didn't really have a future, I didn't feel like I should be going out dating. Who would want to get into a relationship with me when this is all that's going to be coming down the road? So I worked, and that's how I filled my life. And then when all of a sudden I lost that, I had nothing.
When Vanessa Swindell was 31, her childhood diabetes became an adult catastrophe. She lost vision in one eye, slipped into a coma that led to months of intensive care, nursing homes, and onto a long waiting list for both kidney and pancreas transplants.
And that's when it was just me, my little room, and contemplating what I didn't see as much of a future. And nothing really worked out the way I had pictured it in my head. I was going to be independent, take care of myself, and not need anybody. And it completely changed for me.
A lifelong New Jerseyite and graduate of Rutgers University, Vanessa can no longer keep her administrative job at a hospital. Her bosses, who themselves are doctors, told her to apply for Social Security disability insurance.
I fought going out on disability for months and months and months. My doctors had to force me.
Vanessa was healthy when she began working and contributing to Social Security at 15 years old. She is now one of the 30% of Americans who become disabled before they reach retirement. For Vanessa, Social Security was crucial.
When I went into the coma, I was in the hospital for months. The bills were astronomical. In intensive care for months. And then to go into a nursing home, it does make sense that Medicare will pay a hospital for acute care for a patient as long as they need it.
Vanessa's disability and her Social Security qualified her to receive Medicare to pay for her hospital care.
When I was in the coma, I needed it. When I came out of the coma and was well enough, I wasn't well enough to go home, but I was not sick enough to be in a hospital. Medicare would stop paying at a certain point. So the hospital is absorbing the cost of me being there. So they send in the little nursing homes with their little brochures trying to get me out of there. I went to the nursing home, which if I didn't have disability, didn't have Medicare, I would have had to sign my house over to that nursing home, which I would have completely given up at that point. I only made it there a couple of weeks and I left to go home and die. That was my plan. I just couldn't take it. And if I had no place to go, I don't know what I would have done.
If she didn't have Social Security, she'd have no income at all.
Helene Steinhauser is a social worker at the hospital. She helps kidney transplant patients apply for government and private financial assistance programs.
Not that Social Security pays anything extravagant that you could live off of that, but, you know, it does help pay the bills.
It's made it possible for me to cover my bills, most of them. I mean, there's every month, unfortunately, I have to pick which utility I can put off paying this month, which one's going to get disconnected if I don't pay it this time.
The disability also helped her because she had Medicare. She really didn't have a way to pay for her medication, so New Jersey has a program called PAAD, Pharmaceutical Assistance for the Aged and Disabled. And because she had disability, that helped her get on that, and her Social Security, I mean, her Social Security was not a lot of money, and it's based on need and being disabled or being, you know, senior citizen. And it's an excellent program because each of her medications only cost $5 each. Without that, the medications after transplant are about, say, $3,000 a month.
For a long time, for years, I went through, I'd say, at least $20,000 worth of savings just paying for medication costs and doctor's fees and those 20% balances that Medicare doesn't cover for the few years prior to even the need for the transplant and dialysis. So I was down to nothing. So if I did not have Helene helping me get that program and qualify for that program, then I would not have gotten the transplant. I would have been denied. Because if I can't pay for the medications at $3,000-$4,000 a month, mine were up to, you miss those medications, two or three doses, and you lose the organs. There's no other way around it. I wouldn't have been able to afford it. I couldn't have guaranteed that I could take care of myself and get the medications.
Since its creation as a worker retirement program in 1935, the Social Security program has been debated, changed, and modified dozens of times. Mostly, the changes have expanded the program. In the 1950s, benefits for the disabled were added. Today, it acts as a $300,000 insurance policy, which adjusts with the cost of living. 13 million workers who become disabled or whose spouse or parent has died receive these benefits.
Having this available as a guarantee that I know it's going to be there for me, my check is going to come every month. It's not going to be based on how the stock market's doing. It's going to come every month, and I can at least know that out of all the other things to worry about, that I don't have to worry about that, is so important.
But in recent years, officials want to fix a system they claim is broken. President Bush assembled a commission in 2001 to strengthen Social Security. He directed the commission to include private accounts and a gradual reduction of benefits, which they did. That commission also recommended that another commission be created to address disabled and deceased beneficiaries. Yet the recent political debate on reforming Social Security has focused only on creating private investment accounts and has largely ignored the millions of Americans who receive Social Security for reasons other than retirement. Meanwhile, Vanessa anticipates the first of the month, when her Social Security check will arrive in the mail.
And here I am. Nothing turned out the way I had expected, but I'm also in a better place than I've ever been in my life because I had no hope and was afraid to hope. But the fact that having the transplants, having Social Security be there for me to make sure that I was not denied any of these things that ultimately saved my life and actually gave me a life, not just an existence.
For Making Contact in New York, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit us on the web at radioproject.org. Coming up, we'll hear from the nation's teens on how they view the debate over Social Security. In the year 2041, when the fund's trustees say Social Security will run out of money, those in their teenage years today will not have reached retirement age. Most likely, they'll still be working. Those that do have after-school jobs are currently paying taxes into Social Security with each paycheck. But if the Bush administration succeeds in privatizing the program, today's teens face an uncertain retirement. And yet, many of the country's young people are either unaware of the debate over Social Security or simply don't care. According to a poll by ABC News and The Washington Post, less than 40% of people under 18 say they know about Bush's plan to privatize Social Security. From Boulder, Colorado, emerging reporter John Herndon has more.
Most adults are probably aware of the raging debate over Social Security. But what about the nation's young people? Some students at Boulder High School in Boulder, Colorado, were totally unaware of what Social Security even is, let alone the discussion over its future solvency.
I know nothing about Social Security.
What?
I don't know, man.
Has numbers.
Is that like the people that like walk around and make sure everybody's okay?
I'm too tired to care.
No, I don't know anything.
Such ignorance may be surprising, given that many teens hold jobs and contribute a part of every paycheck, just over 6%, into Social Security. Take Fania Fall, for example. She works at a used bookstore in Boulder. I had the chance to talk to Fania during one of her shifts.
I've only worked at one store, the used bookstore, and I've worked there now for 3 years in February.
Do you mind me asking how much you make?
The salary on my paycheck says $8.50 an hour. I pay $1.50 of that approximately for taxes and all that stuff.
I don't know how much of it actually goes to Social Security. For every $100 I make, I pay $7.11 in Social Security.
So do you know what Social Security is?
Actually, no, I don't.
Does it worry you that you may only get 80% of what you pay in?
I think that we should eventually get all of it back, because we earned it, and we should keep it.
Do you think that as a kid you should have some responsibility to know about Social Security so that you can make sure that you do get it?
Even though I'm just a kid, I should know exactly what Social Security is and how much I'm paying and how much of it I'm going to get back eventually and when.
There are many kids like Fania who work, yet few have started to think about retirement, let alone the pros and cons of Social Security reform. But not all students are as uninformed or apathetic. Many have strong opinions about current issues, and some are even aware that Social Security is a major topic of debate right now. One such student is Brooks Proctor. He's currently a senior at Fairview High and president of the Underground Republicans of Boulder, a network of Republican students around the city. He's also knowledgeable and opinionated about Social Security, something that sets him apart from most of his peers. Like many conservatives, Proctor says Social Security is a dysfunctional system.
It's not supposed to provide an opportunity where someone at the age of 65 can all of a sudden buy three Corvettes and a brand new $500,000 house. It's meant to basically keep them from going into poverty in their retirement years. The people who are in poverty, for example, in the current Social Security system, it doesn't provide enough money for them to stop working. I know you can't expect youth to know everything about basically the current system or the new one that's being suggested, but it's very important that in particular my generation, people that are around 20 years and younger, really pay attention to it, because that's who it's going to affect the most.
With so many young people either uninformed or apathetic about Social Security, will anything get them motivated about the issue? Fernando Ramirez is a high school student and a board member with the United States Student Association, a national organization devoted to the interests of students, like jobs and tuition costs. Ramirez doesn't like the idea of privatizing Social Security, and he has a few ideas about how to convince other young people like him to oppose the Bush administration's plans.
I think for me, I would be twofold. One would be education, and I think the second is actually being part of the discussions. I mean, it's so much about being educated on it, but being able to actively make policy changes with as an organization, I think is secondly what I think would be what students should mobilize on. I think once students do find out what is actually going on, I think that's the best thing. Right now, the plan is really just to privatize Social Security, and I think the best evidence against that is a recent study that was released by the Congressional Budget Office. Showed that young workers can expect higher benefits from Social Security than from a system that's privatized. And I think, I mean, the Congressional Budget Office is a nonpartisan office in D.C., and I mean, and I think that's a pretty powerful statement coming from that office. And the current plans to privatize it, the markets are just unstable, and to move towards a plan that's stable, that focuses on the markets, I think is unstable for us, and you know, and it's not fair that the people that are making decisions are willing to jeopardize our future without having us being at the table.
Although Ramirez says young people have a stake in the outcome of the debate over Social Security, he admits that the decisions over the program's future do not lie in their hands.
What adults would have to be aware about is that supposedly youth are part of this discussion, but we're not. I mean, youth are going to be negatively impacted by what's being proposed currently for Social Security, and I think it's a misconception to think that students are agreeing with what's going on. We don't agree because we're not at the table. And I think, first off, before any changes are implemented, that is what people need to take into consideration.
Brooks Proctor, although he backs privatization, agrees that teens don't have much of a voice in the debate, but that their opinions are important.
What a lot of this is about, Social Security and everything, is actually what the current generations want to do. Because what you decide basically affects us more than basically we decide at this age. We don't have the power yet. We will one day, and we can prepare ourselves. And that's why I encourage education and you know, just doing as much research as possible. But it really comes down to what you as adults decide.
Any decisions made over Social Security today will matter greatly to the current generations of teens when they're old enough to retire. Whether or not their views will play a role in the policymaking by their parents' generation depends ultimately on their own level of awareness and concern. For Making Contact, this is John Herndon.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to Eric Weinberg, Barry Gordimer, and NPR for the Social Security parody song, and to musician Kevin Moore. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Making Contact is an independent production funded primarily by generous gifts from the community. We're committed to providing a unique forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you'd like to support our work, or if you have ideas for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. For a cassette or CD copy of program number 1705, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Pauline Bartolone, associate producer, Dorian Taylor, communications manager, Esther Mania, office manager, Tom Evans, development associate, Peggy Law, founding director, Norman Solomon, senior advisor, David Barsamian, national advisor, and I'm your host and associate producer, Justin Beck.